Good morning. I'd like to convene the Labor and Consumer Protection Division of the Minnesota House of Representatives. Welcome everyone here today. The school marm in me says we start on time and we end on time. It also says bathroom passes. I'm going to try to restrain that instinct. We have three bills on the calendar because one was removed. Thank you very much. One moment. All right. Okay. Representative Obermueller, unfortunately, you are second on the agenda.
Okay. Thank you.
And I apologize for any miscommunication. Representative Bingham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for reminding the first-termers.
that the retirees go first? Is that...
You're not a member on the committee, right? Thank you.
Yep, you guys can come
up.
Can I take a
no
vote right now?
I can see.
whatever feels most comfortable today, Representative Murdoch.
Of course, I did not mean that for any of the first-termers on this committee.
There you go. Representative Bingham, why don't I move House File 1746 to be recommended to pass and we refer to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think what I would like to do on this is have the testifiers give their testimony about House File 1746, which deals with inflatable amusement equipment and their stories on why this bill is necessary, and then I will come back and describe the amendment and the bill and then obviously open up for questions and other testifiers.
All right. Very good.
So, Lisa, if you want to go first.
Sure. Hi, I'm Lisa Schmidt. I'm from Victoria, Minnesota.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Schmidt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. 2 years ago yesterday, our middle son, Ryan, who was 5 years old at the time, was seriously injured at an indoor inflatable party zone. He was jumping at the base of a 20-foot inflatable slide when he went over the slide, landing headfirst on commercial-grade carpeting, lying directly on concrete. He suffered a skull fracture and a brain injury, and he has recovered, but will never know the long-term effects of his injury. These inflatable indoor amusement parks are all the rage, catering to young families at birthday parties where parents sign a waiver, giving up their legal rights, and dropping their kids off, fully believing their children are playing safely and being monitored by trained operators. Often, this just is not the case. Other Minnesota children have been seriously injured at these indoor inflatable amusement ride establishments. In 2007, Carter Justice of Plymouth suffered a shattered skull and a brain injury when he went off the top of a 20-foot inflatable slide and hit the floor. He spent 5 days in intensive care. In 2009, Andrew Fashing of Chaska, my district, suffered a badly broken arm requiring surgery and a hospital stay when he played on an inflatable, and another child had to go seek out the trained attendant for assistance. In 2008, Grant Rosenberger of South St. Paul suffered a brain injury on an inflatable. No adults witnessed the accident, and doctors and parents had to rely on the testimony of other children at the birthday party to try to figure out why he was unconscious. In each of these cases, trained attendants were not supervising the inflatables as the business advertises that they do. Indeed, having a trained operator supervise the use of an inflatable is a requirement of the manufacturer, the inflatable industry as a whole, through the ASTM standards for these products, and the United States Consumer Product Safety Commission. The operation manual of the slide that my son was injured on requires a trained operator to be on duty at all times. The ASTM standard for the inflatable industry, which many states have adopted in its entirety into law, requires one trained attendant per inflatable ride and padding on the floor surrounding the inflatable to protect from injury. The United States Consumer Product Safety Commission published a bulletin in 2001 requiring a trained operator for each inflatable and two for slides over 18 feet. In a report published just last year by the Consumer Product Safety Commission, there was an estimated 31,069 emergency room treated injuries from just 2003 to 2007, 4 years, associated with these indoor inflatable amusement rides. These oversized, commercial-sized inflatables are exactly that. They're rides. In our state, the Amusement Park Law 184B makes no reference to inflatable amusement rides. This growing industry is completely unregulated in our state, putting Minnesota children at serious, serious risk. Having a trained operator on duty is absolutely essential for the safety of jumpers. In fact, the lack of trained supervision accounts for approximately 43% of all injuries on inflatables, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics in a study last year. Playing on inflatables is not the same as playing at a neighborhood or a city park. However, when a child can climb on anything, jump, fall, be pushed, there needs to be protection on the ground to minimize injury. Industry-created ASTM standards require protection on any landing surface surrounding the inflatable. Without laws in place to enforce the very supervision that these inflatables require by the manufacturer, the ASTM industry standards, and the Consumer Product Safety Commission standards, these inflatable party zone establishments will continue to be wild free-for-all danger zones. Parents will continue to falsely believe the industry is operating safely. Parents will sign away their legal rights, leaving their children unsupervised in commercial-sized inflatables at establishments that don't carry medical coverage. Tragically, 18-year-old Seth Kilstadius from Two Harbors died on May 21, 2004, when flipping from the top of an inflatable slide when his head hit the floor in a school gymnasium. While this bill does not seek to regulate the inflatable rental industry, we feel strongly that Minnesota companies in business for profit from the play of young children should be required by law to follow the manufacturer's equipment requirements, their own industry standards, and the guidelines of the United States Consumer Product Safety Commission. Thank you.
Ms. Schmitz, there's another testifier at the desk?
Yes.
Ma'am, welcome to the committee. If you'd please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
My name is Jennifer Rosenberger, and I'm from South St. Paul. Welcome, Mr. Chair and members. First, I want you guys to visualize in your head a minute if you have a child at home or if you have godchildren, grandchildren, neighborhood kids, nieces or nephews. I just want you to think for a minute. Think in your head them playing, running, having fun, jumping around. Now, that was what my son was doing right before he went on this trip. So my son Grant left for a fun-filled birthday party at Pump It Up. The next thing I knew, I had a phone call at 7:57 that Grant wanted me. He fell and hit his head. My mother's instinct was to get him. I had a baby who was nursing and hungry, so my husband, who was running errands, was going to get him. At 8:07, I called my girlfriend's cell phone to ask how he was and what had happened and how to get my husband to Pump It Up. 15 minutes later, my girlfriend called me back, not one phone call from Pump It Up. I could hear my son screaming in the background, a scream I have never heard. I told them immediately to call 911. So here's our first problem. Where was this trained staff member? Where was the supervision person that was watching out for my child? There was no one there watching my child. There was no one there to even greet my husband when he walked in the door besides the emergency worker, the EMTs, and my girlfriend. No calls were made from Pump It Up. The 911 call, the phone call to me, and the phone call I called were all my girlfriend's cell phone. That, to me, is a big problem, that this company didn't step up. Those are big, big issues for me. Next, my husband got there. Grant was lying on the floor. He couldn't stand. He was screaming like a baby, waving his arms over his head. Their paramedics wanted to see if Grant changed at all when his dad got there and when his dad talked to him. Nothing changed. My husband quickly picked up my son and told the EMTs, "We need to go now to the nearest hospital." Second problem. Again, no one working there ever greeted my husband. No one working there, none of these trained staff members, could tell me or the EMTs what happened to my son. And this is a kid who is an 8-year-old little boy screaming bloody murder, arms up, could not walk, could not talk at this point. Trained staff, where are they? In the ambulance, Grant was unresponsive many times and unconscious. The doctors tried to have IVs in, but Grant was trying to rip them out when he would come to. He also had two CTs because the first one he was so disorientated and it wasn't taking very well. His blood pressure was really high and his oxygen count was dropping low. When I got there, he had no idea who I was at all. It was like he was looking, just looking at me like I'm looking at you guys, like no idea, just looking through me. I gave him his blanket that he's had since he was a baby. He held on to it, and he'd look at me, and then his head would drop again onto the bed, and he would be out. Then the next thing, he'd wake up screaming, screaming, screaming. And he kind of held his blanket, but I think he didn't really know why this was comforting him. He would look at me in 2 seconds and go back to screaming, and then 2 seconds later, back to being out. And he was and when he would go out, he would be completely unconscious. So he'd try hitting the they'd try hitting the bottom of his feet. They'd try hitting right here, which usually wakes people up. Nothing. The doctors made the choice to move him to HCMC, which is a head trauma hospital. We all knew this was not a good sign. He had bleeding on his brain. He hit his head so hard that his brain was bleeding inside his skull, which your skull protects. On the way to HCMC, again, Grant was unconscious and unresponsive. When they got to HCMC, they did yet another CT because they're worried that why he keeps going in and out of consciousness. Up to the PIC unit we were, and all night long was a waiting game. The neurosurgeon said if Grant didn't wake up by 6 a.m., we would do another CT to see where the bleeding was and if there was more bleeding and swelling going on. By 4 a.m., Grant mumbled, "Ma," and back out again. That was all I heard, and I cannot tell you how excited I was to hear that. I jumped up. The nurse was sitting. He had a 24-hour nurse sitting by his side. That's all she did was sit by his side. And she said, "I think that was good." Well, then we tried to wake him up more, and he wouldn't wake up. The nurse and I tried to get more, but nothing happened until about a half hour later. And again, I got the, "Ma, I need to open," and back out again. Grant was opening his eyes and not screaming, and we were so excited for that. We were moving in the right direction. Although we are very lucky to this day, Grant still has problems. His mood has changed. He gets frustrated easy, upset faster, and if he's tired at all, will cry and get mad really easy. We have 5 children in our house, so being tired is kind of a common thing. So for him, we have to cope with this every day, and we have to try to teach a 10-year-old that he has to cope with these issues and try to figure out how to learn to deal with them. These are things that we will have to cope with forever. This was a life-changing event. I personally cannot stand by and let other children get hurt or other mothers sign a waiver thinking that there is going to be someone watching their children. That would be like sending my child to a daycare and not checking if she's licensed and not checking if she's doing the proper things. Crazy. Laws need to be made to protect our children. They are our future. From places that are supposed to be fun. This was supposed to be a fun thing with a trained professional to tell people when you're doing something wrong and when to stop and when not to. Grant was at a birthday party at Pump It Up that tells parents on their website to relax. They'll take care of everything. They certainly don't watch the children as of right now because there is no laws that tell them they need to. Because to this day, they have no idea how my son got hurt besides what you heard from other 8-year-olds. The neurosurgeons say for him to have hit something to make his brain bleed, he had to hit something very hard. He had to come down on something. They said, you'll probably never know what exactly he hit. But to say that what the kids are saying is, well, he might have hit someone. And the Pump It Up people are saying, oh, he hit another kid. He had to have hit another kid. The neurosurgeons don't really quite believe that that's what happened. No other kid came up and told us he hit him. And to hit someone's shoulder or knee and have a brain bleed, a moderate brain injury, and be unconscious, and the concussion. That is basically what is in our reports that Grant has. So I am asking you people to please pass this bill. Please think of these kids. And all we're asking is that they have more trained staff per inflatable, and so that the children can be protected in these fun environments. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rosenberger. Representative Bingham, you have an amendment?
Yep, I have the DE2 amendment, and I would ask that it be adopted so I can have the bill in the form I would like.
The chair moves the H-1746 DE2 amendment to be before the committee. As Representative Bingham stated, this is to get the bill in the form that she prefers. All those in favor of the motion, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Bingham, to your bill is amended, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I also want to thank Dolly for helping out on this. I really appreciate their advice on doing this. I'm going to quickly go through the bill. I also want to thank Representative Coles and Representative Smith for co-authoring this bill with me. The Subdivision 1, our definitions, and I just want to make it clear, as the testimony says, that this is not regulating the rental part. So if Representative Sanders had a birthday party for his children in his backyard, this would not be regulating that aspect of it. Subdivision 2 is basically saying that you can't have the inflatable for commercial use in this state unless it complies with this. We're asking that the ASTM standards be adopted, which are the American Society for Testing Materials, at these facilities like Pump It Up. We're asking that supervision be required at the ratio of supervisors to the amount of equipment that is there. So if there's three slides and there are three supervisors, we're asking that insurance be required, and we're asking that these companies register with Dolly and pay a $100 fee for it, and that Dolly be the agency that will enforce. The one thing, talking with the Senate author yesterday, was discovered that either 35 or 34 states do regulate this industry, and that in my discussions with the Department of Labor and Industry, that currently if either of these testifiers would have called Dolly to say, hey, my son was unfortunately hurt at this facility, that there is no jurisdiction for Dolly to go in and take a look at things. So I believe this is a very reasonable bill. I would appreciate the committee's support on it, and the three of us will stand for questions.
Thank you. Questions for the author or the testifiers? Representative Mahoney.
At this time, would it be appropriate to ask Dolly to answer some questions or
come to the table? Well, I was going to open it up to the public. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify either for or against House File 1746? Then question, Representative Mahoney, for Dolly. If someone from the department would please come forward. We've got looks like a couple of people here who might be able to speak for the department.
No, you guys can.
I do want to say that I
Representative Mahoney.
Compliment Representative Bingham for bringing a bill forward that's uncontroversial.
Sir, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is John Schultz. I'm an assistant director within the Construction Codes and Licensing Division of the Department of Labor and Industry. My section currently administers 184B, which is the amusement ride chapter.
Thank you. Mr. Schultz, do you have any comment to the bill, or do you just wish to respond to questions?
No. Mr. Chair, I did meet with both of the authors, and we did make some technical changes that are referenced or are reflected in the amendment.
All right. Thank you, sir. Representative Mahoney, questions to the testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Schultz, could you explain your how you intend to inspect or regulate these particular rides, commercial rides? You know, I have some background in what your department does and doesn't do. I'm a little worried that we're asking you to do something without the resources to do it. So although this is not a finance committee, I don't want to get too deeply into that, but I would like us to understand, are you looking at hiring a new inspector? Are you going to be adding on to your inspection division's workload at this particular point, and how much time you expect your department to have to invest in this.
Mr. Schultz, before you respond, Representative Mahoney, I want to thank you for reminding members that this is not a finance committee. The tradition in this committee is that we deal with the elements of a bill that are germane to the jurisdiction of this committee, and if there are other elements of a bill, those are dealt with in other committees as it goes forward. So just wish to reinforce that. Thank you.
I'm close to that line, so I'm trying.
I'll let you know. Mr. Schultz, thank you, sir.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, currently, as I mentioned, my section administers 184B, and that enforcement is really done through the electrical inspection section, which making electrical inspections in accordance with 326B or Chapter 326B, we simply do the enforcement on the 184B at the same time. In this particular instance, there's a registration requirement. There's a fee for that registration. That registration, in effect, gives the department then the authority to take disciplinary action, to revoke registrations if necessary. It also gives the department the authority to assess monetary penalties up to $10,000 per violation. With regard to hiring of additional employees, we would not anticipate any additional employees. We anticipate that the administration of this may add one-eighth of an FTE. We would look to as this doesn't have this bill doesn't require any particular inspection. We would simply be responding regarding complaints, as well as discovery of facilities that would be covered by the registration requirement. We obviously have personnel that are situated across the state that are they have offices, many of them home offices in all areas of the state. So we believe we're well suited or positioned to administer these provisions.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Schultz, you did answer one of my questions, which was how often were you going to do personal visits to some of these sites, which, as tough as it is in these financial times to actually do that, I am a bit worried that, no offense to the electrical trades, that they may not be altogether that, they're good at current, but maybe not, accidents. So I don't think you can answer that particular question here, but it is a concern of mine that you're having electrical inspectors going out kind of regulating this particular issue. The other is from a past Department of Labor and Industry bill that I carried. My question, I'm going to put it this way. How are you going to notify these operators that they have to have people there, and are you going to get an acknowledgement that they got your notification? Because from a past bill, we've had to open up a window three or four different times because people said, well, Dolly didn't do their job. But having gone through what Dolly did to notify these people, they did do their job, and they're just getting a bad rap. So I guess that's kind of a backhanded compliment to the commissioner over there. But I do want to know if you plan on asking for a response from the place that the witness was talking about or the one up in wherever.
Mr. Schultz.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, we have identified initially a number of these facilities. There are websites that actually list the facilities within the state. We will be using that mechanism. We would also be using there's organizations or manufacturers, companies that have franchises throughout various areas. We'll be using those types of avenues to communicate with that industry and with those entities that we're able to identify. Again, as I mentioned, we've got workers or employees that are situated throughout the state. What we will we'll also be asking them to be vigilant, verify or determine whether or not there are any of these facilities in the areas that or in the districts that they operate in. So, you know, we don't believe that it'll be much of an issue here regarding that. It's different, I believe, than some of the other situations where we're had deadlines for people to qualify for qualify for licensure or registration. There is no deadline associated with this. It's a requirement that they be registered. There is no deadline by a date by which they have to. When this law goes into effect, they need to be registered. We're obviously going to communicate as best we can with them to ensure that they are notified, and that's I believe is the best we can do.
And one more. And
this, Representative Mahoney.
This is to the witnesses. I'm grateful that you brought this bill forward. I think it's about time we make sure that our kids are safe in these particular areas. I kind of had the same thought when my children were much younger. Your job isn't done, though, with this testifying and the passing of this bill. The department does a really good job at what we ask them to do, but you have to stay. You have to make a couple of phone calls to the department and keep track of them. No offense. Thank you.
Any other questions from members of the committee? Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, too, would like to first compliment Representative Bingham for bringing this forward. I think it is certainly sorely needed. And thank the testifiers for giving us your personal stories, which were extremely compelling. And we certainly wish the best for your son. Wondering if has there been any follow-up from the facilities that you're at and any provision for medical costs that you've incurred?
I will ask the responses to be brief.
Okay.
Thank you.
No, the neurosurgeons, when he was in, asked me to call and just ask if they had video so that they could try to see what happened, because we were trying to pinpoint what happened. And so we called. They had called us back and said no, they didn't. And that was the last phone call that we ever got from Pump It Up. I believe that my insurance did go after their insurance and get the medical bill paid. That was part of, you know, that we would have paid, because we got the bill, and then we got a sheet from my insurance, which I'm sure everyone in this room has probably gotten at some time if you've fallen or did something, and they have you fill out what happened, where you fell, da-da-da-da-da, and then we never got another bill. So far as that.
Thank you, Ms. Rosenberger. Ms. Schmitz.
And in my circumstance, we did have a very difficult time finding an attorney that would take on the waiver aspect of it, but we did, and we had to litigate, and we were able to recuperate our deductible.
Oh, thank you. Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you again for bringing this bill forward, Representative Bingham, and thank you very much for coming today to the testifiers, and our prayers are with you, and we thank you for bringing your testimony today. I do have a question for Representative Bingham, or I don't know, I guess whoever could answer this, but one of the questions is, how many of these inflatable parks or Pump It Ups do we have in the state of Minnesota?
Representative Bingham? You've been going through the yellow pages?
What's that?
Mr. Schultz.
Chairman.
You've done your homework.
I've done some preliminary investigation, and there's a website that is related to this industry that identifies a number of providers in various states, and that particular website identifies 50 in Minnesota. I suspect that there are others, but that's a fairly reliable source, but I believe there may be more than that. And this is, as the testifiers have identified, this is an expanding industry, so I believe there will be many more than 50.
Okay. Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would assume things vary quite a bit, but how many inflatable units, I guess, to the testifiers were there at for say a Pump It Up? I mean, we're talking, there's just three or four, are there 20? How many inflatable units would you say?
Ms. Schmitz.
My son was injured at the Pump It Up in Eden Prairie, and at that facility there are two what they call arenas, Arena A and Arena B. They're supposedly separated to keep unlike-sized children apart playing from one another. The night that my son was there, both arenas were open. Each arena had four inflatables, and the arenas were open, and kids of all sizes and adults alike were jumping on the inflatables, and there were two employees on duty.
Okay. Anything else, Representative Sanders?
That'll do it, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Loon.
And I apologize, Mr. Chair. I have one other question. I forgot to ask it.
Mm-hmm.
One last question for perhaps Representative Bigham or for the representative from the agency. Trained supervisor, is that something that's going to be subject to rulemaking in terms of defining what constitutes training? Because I'm, you know, obviously if you're talking about, you know, watching over the inflatables and children, but you know, is there some measure of whether it's life-saving training or something that would be required as a component?
Mr. Schultz.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loon, the ASTM standards do identify the training requirements, and it's really based on the type of inflatable, the type of amusement ride, and the manufacturer's requirements. These devices obviously vary significantly in type, size, and then subsequent need for the training and supervision. So it's covered by the manufacturer's requirements, which is a part of the standard.
Representative Bingham, any final comments?
I would just like to say thank you for your time, and I appreciate your support on this bill.
All right. With that, the chair renews his motion that House File 1746, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Congratulations, Representative Bingham.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Obermueller. As we're transitioning here, Ms. Rosenberger's testimony reminds me that Minnesota relies heavily on Hennepin County Medical Center when the chips are down. We're not always clear on whether we want to pay for Hennepin County Medical Center, but we certainly want the services.
Oops.
Representative Lilly.
Yes, sir.
Would you
be happy to move the minutes if, is that what you're
thinking? I actually was going for the bill.
Yes, I'd be honored to move Representative Obermueller's bill.
All right, thank you very much. Representative Lilly moves that House File 2781 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Representative Obermueller, welcome to the committee. To your bill, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's always a little nervous when Representative Lilly wants to do something on my behalf. He's my seatmate on the floor, and I know he's a bit of a prankster, so that makes me a bit nervous, but... what I'd like to do is we actually have two amendments that are coming through, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure if you'd like to act on those first, and then if that's okay, we'd prefer that.
Certainly. Representative Lilly, would you move the A-10-21-28 amendment that's coming around?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. Representative Obermueller, this is to get the bill in the order you prefer?
That's correct, and I'm happy to discuss it in a bit. They're actually positive changes I think the committee will like. So,
All those in favor of the A-10-21-28 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. We have a second amendment, Representative Obermueller?
Right. Mr. Chair, this is it's A-10-21-19, which I believe was already in your packets.
Oh, very good.
I'd be happy to move that as well.
Thank you very much, Representative Lilly. Representative Lilly moves the A-10-21-19 amendment be before the committee. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Obermueller, to your bill is amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is a bill that came from the Department of Labor and Industry, and it's a bill that seeks to essentially take our license system and make it more efficient and more transparent, which is something we're all working towards, I think, here at the Capitol. It collects all the various contractor license fee provisions that are part of the construction code and licensing division at DALI, and it moves them into one statutory location. It converts these fees so that they're similarly situated contractors are treated similarly. In other words, if they're on the same skill level across a plumber versus some other trade or so forth, they're treated similarly. It makes sure that the fees that we collect are related to the cost of administering the program that we're trying to do, so that we have identified contracts or contractors who have continuing education pay for continuing education, as opposed to everybody paying and sharing that cost. It basically balances out. It makes the fee that you pay for the license you're getting related to the fee that should be paid for that fee. This is smart reform, I think, and while some fees do go up, many, many others go down, and some go down a whole lot. And you'll see on one of the handouts we handed to the two-page form with kind of the list of all the people who are going up and down. And I'm sure you will also go down to that right column and go up and down the aisle and find out who's really paying and who's not and so forth. There is the reason I handed that out is so you can kind of see what's happening to many of the people. But one of the amendments we just adopted actually makes that number, those numbers, a lot better, because the amendment that was the A-10-21-28 actually reduces exam fees, master's fees, and business license fees in that a percentage as well. So the numbers actually go even lower than this. The commissioner is here, which I really appreciate, to explain kind of the process they went through and some of the benefits of the bill. And if, with the chair's permission, I'd like to pass it over to him.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Welcome back to the committee.
Chairman Dabney, thank you very, very much. And let me first thank sincerely Representative Obermueller for carrying this bill. I think it is a bill that has good policy behind it, that follows what the state should be doing in being open, transparent to our citizens, in this case the 108,000 licenses that our department issues, and trying to be efficient as well, as he mentioned. Let me maybe just enhance a couple of things that that Representative Obermueller mentioned, and then certainly maybe, Mr. Chairman, if okay, I do have Assistant Commissioner Tom Joachim here to walk through the particulars of the bill with you.
All right. It's fascinating reading, so.
Okay. 108,000 licenses, members, is approximately what our department issues. One of them, to the distinguished chairman in the back of the room back there, behind you, Mr. Mahoney, gets his high-pressure piping license from us. So he's one of our 108,000. Mr. Chairman, when the CCLD, that's our Construction Codes Licensing Division, was all brought together under executive order of about four and a half years ago, we've been working ever so hard to make sure that we bring together our enforcement, we bring together licensing, we bring together costs, we coordinate between the different licensing divisions that came together at Labor and Industry. This is certainly a big part of that. Transparent, Mr. Chairman, we have spoken to, I think, almost every interest group, stakeholder group, that exists at the Department of Labor and Industry for the 108,000 licenses we issue about this initiative. I do not believe that there is an interest group or a stakeholder group that we have not spoken to, maybe two and three times, because when you're dealing with fees, it's always very sensitive. You and I both know that fees here at the Capitol can, you know, be a very sensitive issue. So we have dealt with the stakeholders in a very, very transparent way. As Representative Obermueller said, these changes are very reflective of and respective of the services, the time that Labor and Industry puts into issuing a license. And I think that is very, very important, that that we be reflective and respective of that time. Mr. Chairman, it also adds great efficiency for our agency, as we will now be able maybe to have individuals go between various licensing units, plumbers, electricians, contractors, and do so with a much greater ability to move from one unit to another. Our license that we issue right now, Mr. Chairman and members, we range all the way from $0 to $450. In a very in a situation that is not very representative of the cost it is for the department to issue those licenses, from zero to 450. When we began this project about a little over a year and a half ago, by the way, the individual who did this project for us is sitting in the back here, Mr. Ed Potter. There were some initial directions that were given. First of all, this change had to be revenue neutral. This bill does not raise any additional revenue for the Department of Labor and Industry from licenses. It is revenue neutral. Representative Obermueller is exactly correct. Some will go up, some will go down, some will stay the same. With the change in the amendment which you just adopted, Mr. Chairman, you should know overall out of the 188,000 licenses, 51% of those licensed by the department will see their license decrease. Now, some only a dollar, but they will see their licenses decrease. 36% will see their licenses increase. Some only a dollar, but 36% will see their licenses increase, and then 13% will see no change in their licenses. Again, it adds efficiency to our department. It is absolutely revenue neutral. There is no increase overall in licenses that will be brought forward in to the citizens that the licenses are issued to from the Department of Labor and Industry. And I think it reflects exactly what good government should be doing, and that's being respective of the services that we provide to our stakeholders and the citizens of Minnesota. So I thank the representative for carrying the bill for us, and would stand for any questions or would turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Joe Aikum to go through the specifics.
Why don't we bring up the Assistant Commissioner, sir? Assistant Commissioner Joe Aikum, welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Tom Joe Aikum, Assistant Commissioner with the Department of Labor and Industry. I'm going to walk you through a short version of the bill. And
short would be good.
If you have any questions, most of the section changes in the bill relate to taking the current fee that's in law in the specific section for electrical, for plumbing, for high-pressure piping, and changing it, deleting it out, and moving it to our table for the four categories of a registered, the entry level, the journeyman level, the master level, or the business license. So all of those categories that we have in the 108,000 licenses we have, if there was a license fee, which was in law, we had to switch all of those to relate to this table. So that most of these changes relate to that. There are two probably major changes. One is in our building official certification, in order to transfer this to the fees have to be in law now. We had some fees that were still in rule, so we changed and added the rule sections relating to the certifications in this chapter to match up with the rest of the categories that we have in our licenses and registrations. The other major piece we did is for years the plumbing licensing law only required only allowed the master plumber to hold the business license. And so if you were a master plumber and wanted to have your plumbing business, you had to have your master license, and then you had to obtain a bond to act as a contractor. That was the only one we have that didn't have a separate contractor license. And what that disallowed was any of us that are not licensed plumbers could not own a plumbing business. And all the other licenses we have, electrical, high-pressure piping, boiler, whatever it is, residential building contractor, water conditioning, I could own one of those businesses and not hold one of those licenses, provided my quality person holds that master license. And so long as I have a master plumber or a master electrician working for me, then I could hold that contractor license. So we modified the plumbing license to match up with all the rest of the licenses we have with a business license. What that did, just for fee costs, the master plumber license used to be $100, and the bond was $40. That was $140. The new fee license will be $40 for the master license and $80 for the business license, $120 plus a board fee. So it would be less than what it was before for the master plumber. They're just going to have to apply for that business license to make sure that if they continue to want to be the business license. Other than that, the rest of it is all tied to just switching the license fees and matching up to address, whether it's electrical or plumbing or water conditioning, that the license fees now fit into one of those four categories.
Thank you very much. Any questions for the testifiers? Representative Obermueller, is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or against this legislation? Representative Obermueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My final comments would be, it's regrettable that anybody has to pay more on their fee this time around, and there are a few folks that are going to pay a little bit more. At least they'll know that the transparency is there, that the fee is tied to what is actually going on at the department. I really appreciate the department's efforts to do this, what I think is smart reform, and I'd appreciate the members' support.
Very good. With that, Representative Lilly renews his motion that House File 2781, as amended, be recommended to pass, and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom. It's a bit of a Groundhog Day. Haven't we seen this bill before?
You have, Mr. Chair, but it's different than the last time you saw it.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom and committee members, the jurisdiction of this committee, I've been advised, is limited to Article 1 of the bill. So pages 1 to 11 is my understanding, or maybe a bit of 12, I'm not sure. No, 12.27, I'm told, by the people who are precise in the room. So, Representative Hillstrom, welcome to the committee. The Representative Simon, would you be willing to move House File 2613 to be before the committee?
I will.
Recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Thank you very much. Any amendments, Representative Hillstrom?
I have none, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Hillstrom, to your bill then, please. And we will be asking everyone to be, since we've seen this bill before, we voted on something very similar, mm-hmm. Representative Hillstrom?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The changes to this bill, that's what I'll go through.
Okay. We'll just ask that folks be brief because this is not new territory overwhelmingly. Representative Hillstrom, my apologies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As many of you know, this is the Homeowner Lender Mediation Bill, and we have been working very hard on this bill, trying to get this bill to become law. And the changes to this bill since the last time it was heard by this committee is that it now does not increase the foreclosure time in Minnesota. It exempts lenders with five or fewer foreclosures in the last 12 months. Borrowers are required to undergo foreclosure prevention counseling before being eligible for mediation. It provides for telephonic mediation. The initial mediation meeting shall be conducted by telephone and subsequent meetings conducted by telephone unless the mediator certifies that personal attendance is necessary. There are bad faith penalties, creditor bad faith, foreclosure continues with the normal 6-month redemption period, debtor bad faith, deed in lieu of foreclosure required in 90 days. So this mediation is still funded with a fee of $1.25, but that's not within the jurisdiction of this committee. So those are the changes since the last time this committee has seen it, Mr. Chair, and I am proud to say that the credit unions now endorse the bill, so we are moving along and getting support. So with that, Mr. Chair, I have Mr. Fichte here for questions, only he doesn't really need to say anything, and then I'd like to let the credit unions go and then whoever else you have here that wants to testify.
Right. Mr. Fichte, you're with the Attorney General's office.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions for either Representative Hillstrom or the Attorney General's office? Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hillstrom, I know we did act on this bill last year, and it was vetoed. It sounds like you've had a few changes to it, but I'm wondering, have you've been working with the credit unions. Have you been working with others to try to develop some consensus on this issue since last year?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have been speaking to anyone who will talk to me, and we are still talking, which is always a good sign. When people are not talking, then you know you have a really bad sign. So we continue to talk and work on this issue, and it is my hope that we can have something that the governor can sign. Thank you.
Very good. You have other testifiers.
Mr. Chair, the credit unions are here, and I'd like them to be able to go next. Come to the table.
Please come on down. Good morning, sir. Good to see you. Welcome back to the committee. Mr. Traylon.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, my name is Jeff Schwallen, committee members. I'm president of Highway Federal Credit Union. We're an $850 million financial located just over here at Rice in Pennsylvania. We've been in business for over 75 years, and I'm also happen to be the chair of our political involvement committee at the Minnesota Credit Union Network.
I'm here to testify today in support of Representative Hillstrom's Homeowner Lender Mediation Act. First off, and I'll be brief, I would like to start by thanking Representative Hillstrom and the Attorney General's Office for the changes they made last year to make the bill something we as credit unions can support. Credit unions were happy to see that the bill does not lengthen the foreclosure time frame, that homeowners will receive counseling first prior to mediation, mediation is not binding, and that there are consequences for homeowners who do not act in good faith in mediation. The bill exempts credit unions with five or fewer foreclosures in a year. We were very happy to see that, recognizing that they are not the target, probably, of this bill. I'm here to tell you that credit unions do not want to foreclose on our members. In 2009, as an example, Highway was able to help 40% of those requesting a workout. On average, our average loss in since 2006 has been $36,000 for each foreclosure. Some of the steps we at Highway have taken are working proactively with local counseling services, working with the Fannie Mae HAMP program, providing loan modifications or extensions to keep our members in their homes. Credit unions decided to support this bill because we are hopeful that it will help make the connections between homeowners and the lender, as well as cut down our losses. Just getting people to overcome the fear of foreclosure, which leads them to ignore the warnings we provide via phone calls and letters, this would be huge. While we still do not feel like we are in the intended target of this legislation, we think it is more important in today's market that this legislation gets passed. And as a side note, we get calls from our membership who do not have their home loans with us, just begging us to help them, and they have used up their time frame between the time that they're in distress to the time of the sheriff's sale, because after that it's very, very hard to help them out by trying to get the attention of the lender, who is typically out of state. So this will go a long way to help these people who are in distress. So with that, I've been brief. I thank you for your time and would be happy to stand for questions.
Thank you very much. Also on the list, Mr. Skilbred. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is David Skilbred, Vice President of Government Relations for the Independent Community Bankers in Minnesota, statewide association of privately held, community-focused small banks. I've got a handout here, if I could maybe leave this with you, and I'll continue with this tradition of being very brief. Number one, we'd like to compliment the author and the members for bringing a bill this year that is much improved over last year's bill as was drafted. We appreciate those changes. With respect to the scope of the bill, we'd still like to see it a little more articulate so that it does not include community bankers. The exemption in the bill, we appreciate the spirit of this, but in small rural communities, if you have one business that might close, and in these challenging times that is happening, that one closure could easily trigger a bank being included in the provision of the mediation. And that has nothing to do with the bank's activities, practices, or products. So while the exemption included for five or less, we understand and we appreciate the spirit, we think that it should be a little more general and broad. The graph that you have before you was put together for me by Housing Link. It shows 1,668 foreclosures in Hennepin County and Ramsey County in 2009, where the lender foreclosing was identified after the sheriff's sale. I think what this shows quite clearly is that community banks are not foreclosing in this area. And secondly, it draws attention to the 89% of the foreclosures by financial institutions having a national or international market or footprint. And I think that these are the target of this bill. It would be great if we could craft verbiage that would more carefully identify those folks. Most of those are going to be 1-800 numbers, I believe. And the problem is going to be where the lenders are not responsive. And that, I think, is the distinction between the lenders that we're trying to get at with this bill as opposed to community banks, where you can walk down the street, walk in the door, and talk to your lender. In brief, I'll just state that the things that we... The one other handout that you have there is numbers put together by the Minnesota Extension Service for mediation cases in 2009 for the Farmer Lender Mediation Program. I give this to you because we are fashioning this bill after that program and find it helpful to see what the results of that program are. As you'll notice, there are 3,107 mediation notices filed in 2009. Of those, 1,192 were mediated, and of those, 422 reached a resolution. So 13.5% of those notices actually completed mediation and reached a resolution. That is a program where counseling is not available. We do have counseling for residential foreclosures as a result of the law, I believe, in 2008 that we passed. The Home Ownership Center, according to their 2008 report, shows that their success rate is in the 56% range or so. To me, that is a very good number. Counseling is working. And the 4 points I'll leave you with then is, number one, we'd like to see the scope drawn a little more acutely so that community bankers are not the target. Number two, we'd like to see the counselors determine eligibility for the mediation. Number three, the Farmer Lender Mediation Program uses the Minnesota Extension Service as the entity in charge of mediation. We feel that some entity like that would be preferred to the Attorney General's office. And with that, I'll leave it to you and try to take any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Skilbred. Any questions for the testifier? Mr. Johnson. I believe Mr. Skilbred's handout talked about your people.
Mr. Chairman, members.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the time.
My name is Steve Johnson. I'm Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Bankers Association. The MBA represents approximately 94% of the banks in Minnesota, so we represent large institutions and small all across the state of Minnesota. And these traditional community banks have been in Minnesota, I would like to state, sometimes for nearly 160 years. The first bank was chartered in Minnesota in 1856, the Root River State Bank. It's still operating in Chatfield, Minnesota. So just a little trivia there for you, Mr. Chair and members. But the point of that is, saying that, is that bank and a lot of banks like it have been there in good times and bad through all the various cycles of our economic history in the United States. My members are employers. They employ approximately 50,000 people in Minnesota. They're civic-minded businesses in their community. They're active in their community. They participate in the food drives and the rotaries and the community fund drives, you know, whatever they are. The bankers are the ones that step up to the plate and participate in those. They are the traditional banks are the economic engine of their communities. They're the heart of their communities. We want to commend Representative Hillstrom and the Attorney General's office for working on foreclosure issues. They've obviously been leaders in that over the years. We have some of the strongest pro-consumer foreclosure laws in the country. Chairman Dabney, you have also been a leader in passing a lot of those laws, and a lot of others here have been participating in that. Just as a reminder, the legislature's passed 22 bills over the last 3 years dealing with predatory lending and foreclosure issues that contain approximately 60 provisions. It's sometimes hard to determine what the actual provision starts and ends, but over 60 provisions and 22 bills over the last 3 years dealing with predatory lending, foreclosure, etc. So a lot of fine work has been done in that area. and we supported many of those pieces of legislation. However, we don't support the mediation bill in its current form that's before you today. I want to be clear that the MBA and its members share the concerns of policymakers regarding the high level of foreclosures in Minnesota. We also think that's a problem, but I want to remind you that foreclosure is a lender's last resort. Traditional banks' goal is to provide a customer's financial services for them throughout their lifetimes. They want to provide their savings accounts, their checking accounts, their CDs, their loans. They want to be working with them throughout their lifetimes, and foreclosure obviously doesn't fit that goal. To avoid foreclosure, sometimes lenders will wait 30, 60, 90 days or more of missed payments before commencing foreclosure proceedings. And during that time, the lender is regularly attempting to contact the borrower over possible options to avoid that foreclosure. And that's the main reason, that's one of the main reasons why we pose this legislation today. We keep hearing that the reason that this legislation is needed is borrowers are not being able to communicate with their lenders. Our traditional community banks were not mentioned, have not been mentioned in that discussion, not being able to be accessed by their customers. They're in their communities. It's easy to find someone to negotiate with. So they are there and willing to work with people and help people out. Beyond that, we passed a very cutting-edge law here in Minnesota in 2008. Mr. Skilbred mentioned it, the pre-foreclosure counseling notice law. That's new, and I'm not aware of any other state in the country that has that law. And what happens with that is when a lender proceeds with foreclosure on a customer, they send the customer's information to a approved counseling agency, and they also send a notice to the borrower saying you have the right to go to counseling. And the counselors aren't here today, but all reports I've seen and some of the testimony they've provided in other committees has demonstrated that's not too new law, a year and a half it's been in place, is working. I mean, people are being served by procedure, that program. So the bottom line is that we think with that law in place and some of the other things in place, that the scope of this bill should be narrowed to maybe fit into that more. Maybe the counselors would have more determination of who would go to mediation, etc., or be eligible for help. So that's kind of point one, is we think the scope should be narrowed. A couple other real quick points regarding this legislation, and then I'll wrap up. I know we're short on time. Some of our members are concerned that the Attorney General would serve as a gatekeeper for this program. I don't think there's any question that the Attorney General is a strong advocate for Minnesota consumers. I mean, they are repeatedly and actively pursuing all kinds of measures to help consumers, no question. But they may be seen as less than a neutral party when choosing a mediator for this program. So we do have a concern about that. And then it's not in the committee's purview, but the $125 fee per filing is also something I'm concerned about, but we'll talk about that another day. So with that, I'll wrap up, and thank you for your time and today.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Members.
Questions for the testifier? Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Johnson, I've met with some people on this particular bill, and I should have asked this to Mr. Skilbred. They tell me that 85% or something like that are international bankers that have split and diced this like a piece of garlic. Mm-hmm. So how are they responding when they get notified that you're going to foreclose on your house? Are these bankers showing up, or are they just like ignoring the certified mail that they get?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, I can't give you an exact answer on that. I don't work with individual lenders or servicers. First of all, I don't represent servicers, so in instances like that, it's more likely that a servicer might be the entity that we're talking about here. I have heard from various banks that I do work with is that they do try and work with the customer to try and figure out ways to try and contact them, etc. And you're right on the point, though, Representative Mahoney. That's probably the critical loan that we're looking at here, the ones that have been securitized and sold in the marketplace. That's probably where it's more challenging to find a person to make a decision to get a workout. I think that most people would agree that's probably the one that we're looking at here. And that's, I was trying to make that distinction without saying that. I mean, the banks I represent are in Minnesota. They're locally, they're here. I mean, they're on the ground. So it's easier to find someone to talk to try and come up with a decision or make a decision, what have you. So I don't know if I answered your question, but
Mr. Skilbred, you've rejoined us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mahoney, the way that I kind of think about this is that
that question asked the question, or the conclusion is that there are some absent lenders out there who, for one reason or another, do not respond to the borrower, do not respond to the customer, and as a result, that's really where the majority of the frustration comes, I believe. And so I think that if this bill can scope and target those lenders, then we can get something positive and take some steps forward. I think the point that I was trying to make is if the customer wants to see a community banker, all they need to do is go down to Main Street and go in the door.
All right. Any other questions for representatives of the banking industry? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Lee. Sure. I appreciate the brevity with which folks have focused their comments, trying to keep folks at right around 5 minutes, 3 to 5 minutes. Ms. Lee, please, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International, R&R Family Centers. By past experience, I've been a former corporate auditor, a banker, realtor, and I do legal advocacy. We supported the bill after it was changed as far as the issue around counseling last year. And again, I wanted to mention that we do believe that counseling or the mediation is needed, and the people that need to be at the table are the attorneys as far as understanding the legal language, and also financial people who understand the finances of it and know how to crunch the numbers, because the normal consumer has problems in these areas, and for the most part, that was part of how they got in some of the trouble in the first place. But I wanted to focus on what we thought was a fix related to the counseling, in that we found that there were some glitches. And so on page 2, in the area where they talk about what a counseling agency is, they say it's someone that has been funded all in part by the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, or HUD. HUD does not finance or fund counseling agencies unless you consider it as a pass-through or if they give scholarships for trainings. The other portion of it says that if it's otherwise approved by HUD. And we found that, again, well, HUD does approve agencies, but there's glitches in how they approve things, so that according to state law, all counselors have to be certified, and there are 4 groups that can certify. On the back of your page that was handed out, the 4 groups that were listed are referred to under, this was language taken out of Statute 58.13, and the 4 groups that can certify counselors are the Minnesota Home Ownership Center, the Minnesota Mortgage Foreclosure Prevention Association. It's the HUD's AARP, and not just the AARP. It's a HUD AARP program, and NeighborWorks America. Now, as far as what's considered approved agencies, HUD has a list of them, and the person who's the expert on HUD has not explained it, because there's ways where courses can be taken, and if it's not from a HUD-approved agency, so for example, under Home Ownership Center, there's agencies that are not approved by HUD, whether or not the person has to retake the course. There are situations where a person has to redo something just because it's not under a HUD-approved agency. So even though they're certified under these other agencies, as far as NeighborWorks America or even the Foreclosure Association, that it might not necessarily count. So we need attempted to find a fix for that, because there are counselors out there who are trained and able to help, and they're not being used. That language also is on page 4, where it's kind of shortened, where they talk about foreclosure prevention counseling agencies as far as being approved by Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and HUD. And so, again, we'd like to kind of close the loophole that's making it so that there's a problem with the usage of counselors. Now, also before you is some information about NeighborWorks America. This was created by an act of Congress as far as providing the training. They are like the parent company of all counseling agencies. So all the counseling agencies named, as far as Minnesota Mortgage Association, Mortgage Foreclosure Association, and Home Ownership Center, they were all their counseling programs were all funneled down after they went through the NeighborWorks America. And so the concern there was as far as the usage of the counselors there and the training, because currently their courses are not taught in Minnesota. So if you're not an approved home ownership agency, and there's only 25 of them, you have to take your courses out of state. That means you go to California. This past year, they went to Louisiana and Tennessee and Washington, D.C. Those were the only places where people should be certified. Now, it's mandated that counselors are certified, but it doesn't make sense to send them out of state to get their certification. So we need to be able to deal with that issue. On the second page, what you have is people who sit on the board as far as the NeighborWorks America. One of them is the Assistant Secretary of HUD, who was appointed by President Obama. And the other is on the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System, appointed by Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke. So they are serious as far as the need for counseling, but we just need to make it work here in Minnesota. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Lee. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I ask for member support. I will continue to work on these issues, and you passed it out last year, and I'm asking you to send it to Commerce again this year. That's it.
All right. With that, Representative Simon, if I remember correctly, renews his motion that House File 2613 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, members.
With that, I'm being told we have the minutes to do. Representative Mahoney. Representative Mahoney moves that the minutes of February 5th be approved. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. With that, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.